Ever wonder how Northern Ireland's journey to peace really began? Well, today we're diving deep into a pivotal decade, 1974 to 1984.
A decade of immense challenges, but also one that holds valuable lessons for anyone interested in conflict resolution and peace building.
It's a period often referred to as the stalemate, where the search for peace seemed agonizingly out of reach.
And that's precisely what we'll be exploring today, drawing insights from a chapter aptly titled Stalemate and the Search for Peace, 1974-1984.
So we're kicking things off in 1974 with Northern Ireland already a tinderbox of political and social tensions, and then boom, the power-sharing executive collapses.
A devastating blow to hopes for a peaceful resolution. Remember, this power-sharing arrangement, agreed upon just a year earlier, was meant to bring the Protestant and Catholic communities together to govern Northern Ireland.
A real glimmer of hope at the time, right?
Absolutely. But its collapse revealed the fragility of peace and the deep-seated divisions that continued to plague Northern Ireland.
So what happens next? Does anyone even try to pick up the pieces?
Well, the British government, determined to find a way forward, proposes the Ulster Constitutional Convention.
Okay, so a fresh start. A chance for the different factions in Northern Ireland to come together and hammer out a new way forward. Sounds promising, at least on paper. What was the intended goal of this convention?
The idea was to create a system of government that everyone could agree on.
A tall order, given the history. So how did it actually play out?
It didn't quite go as planned. The election for the convention revealed just how deep the divisions within Northern Ireland really were.
And by didn't go as planned, I'm guessing we're talking about the UUC?
Exactly. The UUC, a coalition staunchly opposed to power sharing with nationalists, won a landslide victory.
So much for a fresh start.
Their victory basically signaled a return to the old way of doing things, a unionist-dominated government.
Which, let's be honest, wasn't exactly known for its inclusivity. What did this victory mean for those who were hoping for a shared future?
It was a major setback for them. It dashed hopes for a power-sharing solution, which many saw as the only path to lasting peace.
And I imagine it only fueled further division and mistrust between communities.
Sadly, you're right.
It's a good reminder that even with the best of intentions, finding common ground in the midst of such deep-rooted conflict is incredibly difficult.
It certainly is. But it's also worth noting that even amidst this political turmoil, there were some interesting developments. Anne Dixon, for instance, became the leader of the UPNI, the first woman to lead a political party in Northern Ireland.
Wow, that's significant. A sign of progress, perhaps, even as the broader political landscape remained turbulent.
Absolutely. And remember, despite the convention's ultimate failure to produce a lasting agreement, the British government remained committed to finding a political solution. They continued to grapple with the question of how to bring lasting peace to Northern Ireland.
And as we delve deeper into this decade, it becomes tragically clear that the struggle for peace wasn't just happening in the halls of power.
You're right. It was unfolding on the streets, in communities, and tragically, it was costing lives.
This wasn't just about political disagreements anymore. This was about people living in fear, facing violence, and losing loved ones.
Exactly. And that's where Ulsterization comes in, a new policy direction that significantly impacted the conflict.
Ulsterization. I've heard the term, but to be honest, I'm a little fuzzy on the specifics. What did it actually mean in practice?
In a nutshell, it meant shifting the responsibility for security away from the British Army and more towards local forces.
So the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the RUC, and the Ulster Defense Regiment, the UDR.
Precisely. The idea, at least on paper, was to reduce the British Army's presence and give local forces a more prominent role in maintaining security.
Sounds like a risky move given the already heightened tensions. What was the rationale behind this shift?
It's complicated. On the one hand, it was presented as a way to de-escalate the conflict, reducing the target on the backs of British soldiers. The hope was that by relying more on local forces, there would be less of a perception of an occupying force.
Okay, and I'm guessing it didn't quite work out that way.
Not quite. While it did lead to fewer British Army casualties, it unfortunately resulted in a sharp rise in deaths among the RUC and the UDR.
Which, given their composition, further inflamed tensions between the communities.
Tragically, yes. The RUC and UDR were predominantly Protestant, so their increased casualties were seen by many in the nationalist community as further evidence of their vulnerability and the lack of protection from the state.
And on the ground, the violence escalated. Groups like the Shankill Butchers, a loyalist gang, unleashed a wave of terror. Their brutal tactics, the kidnappings, the murders, It's a chilling reminder of just how dark those times were.
Absolutely. Their reign of terror, alongside the IRA's relentless bombing campaign, had a devastating impact, not just in terms of human life, but also on the economy.
I can only imagine. The constant threat of violence, the actual bombings, it must have been incredibly difficult to maintain any sense of normalcy or stability. Businesses must have been terrified to invest, and who would want to visit a place where a bomb could go off at any moment?
You're hitting on a crucial point. The economic consequences of the Troubles were immense. Think about the cost of security, the damage to infrastructure from the bombings, the lost investment. It was a huge drain on an already struggling economy.
And then there was the spillover of violence onto the British mainland itself. The 1974 Birmingham pub bombings in particular stand out as a horrific example.
Absolutely. Those bombings, which killed 21 innocent people and injured nearly 200, sent shockwaves through Britain and really intensified anti-Irish sentiment. It reinforced the perception of the conflict as a threat that extended far beyond the borders of Northern Ireland.
It's a tragic illustration of how violence, especially on that scale, can have such far-reaching consequences and deepen divisions. And to make matters worse, the Birmingham Six Irishmen were wrongfully convicted of the bombing, spending years in prison for a crime they didn't commit.
A terrible miscarriage of justice that only added to the sense of injustice and fueled further resentment.
It's hard to imagine how, amidst such darkness, there could be any room for hope, for a dialogue, for peace. Was there any glimmer of light during this incredibly difficult period?
There was. Even in the midst of such despair, the human spirit found a way to push for peace.
So amidst the violence and the deep-seated mistrust, were there any glimmers of hope? Were there any attempts to find a political solution during this tumultuous period?
Absolutely. Even as the violence raged on, the yearning for peace couldn't be silenced. One of the most inspiring movements that emerged during this time was the Peace People.
The Peace People. Now, their story is a testament to the power of ordinary people to create extraordinary change. I mean, imagine witnessing firsthand the brutal consequences of violence.
That's precisely what sparked the movement. It was born out of a horrific tragedy, the deaths of three children struck by a car driven by an IRA member being chased by security forces.
Just heartbreaking. And from that unimaginable grief, a movement for peace was born.
It's a testament to the resilience of the human spirit, isn't it? Two women, Betty Williams and Mairead Corrigan, one of whom had lost her sister's children in that tragedy, decided they'd had enough of the violence. They organized a peace rally, a call for an end to the bloodshed.
And that resonated with people.
It did. Thousands turned out for that first rally, hungry for peace. The Peace People, as they came to be known, captured the world's attention with their simple but powerful message, a message of nonviolence, reconciliation, and a shared future for all. They went on to organize rallies and marches, bringing together people from all walks of life, united in their desire for peace. Their efforts earned them international recognition, culminating in the Nobel Peace Prize in 1977.
An incredible achievement. Proof that even amidst darkness, hope can find a way. But while these people were advocating for peace and reconciliation, the economic realities of life in Northern Ireland were impossible to ignore. Our sources point to the Quigley Report, which painted a pretty bleak picture of the economic situation, especially for Catholics, who face disproportionately high unemployment rates. So what was being done to address these economic disparities, which clearly played a role in fueling the conflict?
You're right to highlight that link between economic hardship and the conflict. It's a vicious cycle, isn't it? Poverty and lack of opportunity breed resentment and despair, which can, in turn, fuel violence. Recognizing this, Roy Mason, who became Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, decided to prioritize economic intervention. He drew upon the recommendations of the Quigley Report, channeling government funds into struggling industries, hoping to stimulate job creation and revitalize the economy.
And did it work? Did his efforts make a dent in the unemployment rates, especially amongst Catholics?
It's hard to say definitively. Unemployment remained a persistent problem, reaching a staggering 19% by the 1980s. Mason's efforts faced significant challenges, including the broader global economic downturn at the time. But he did make some progress. The Fair Employment Act of 1976 was a significant step, outlawing discrimination based on religion or political beliefs in the workplace. He also made a bold move by supporting Harland and Wolff, a major shipbuilding company on the verge of collapse.
Harland and Wolff, the ones who built the Titanic. That must have been a controversial decision, pouring money into a struggling industry during such difficult economic times.
It was. Many argued that it was throwing good money after bad, but Mason saw it as a necessary step, a way to protect jobs and prevent further economic decline.
A gamble, for sure, but it shows a willingness to try something, anything, to break the cycle of poverty and violence. And speaking of trying to find a path forward, what was happening on the political front? Were there any significant shifts or changes in alliances?
The political landscape was definitely in flux. Within unionism, there were some notable developments. Craig's Vanguard Party, for instance, disbanded, with some members rejoining the Ulster Unionist Party. Meanwhile, the Democratic Unionist Party, led by the Reverend Ian Paisley, continued to gain momentum. Paisley, known for his fiery rhetoric and hardline stance against power sharing with nationalists, was a powerful force in unionist politics.
So it sounds like the divisions within unionism were as deep as ever. And what about the IRA? What was their strategy during this time?
The Provisional IRA, under the leadership of Gerry Adams, adopted a new long-term strategy, which became known as the Long War. This approach signaled a shift away from spectacular headline-grabbing attacks and towards a more protracted campaign of attrition. They believed that by maintaining constant pressure on the British government, they could eventually exhaust their resolve and force a withdrawal from Northern Ireland.
A war of attrition. That sounds grueling, both for those involved in the fighting and for the communities caught in the crossfire.
It was. The Long War strategy led to a more sustained, albeit lower-level, campaign of violence. It was during this period that we saw the rise of what became known as the Troubles, becoming deeply entrenched in the fabric of life in Northern Ireland.
It's hard to imagine the toll that such sustained violence must have taken on communities, on families, on individuals. It's a stark reminder that conflict is never just about politics or ideology, it's about people's lives.
And their deaths, unfortunately. Because alongside the political maneuvering and the ongoing violence, this period also saw a tragic series of events, the 1981 hunger strikes.
The hunger strikes, a pivotal moment, wouldn't you say? The point where the conflict and the prisoners' cause captured the world's attention. What led to this drastic measure?
The hunger strikes were sparked by a dispute over the status of paramilitary prisoners. In 1976, the British government ended what was known as special category status, which had essentially granted political status to those convicted of paramilitary offenses.
So they were no longer treated as prisoners of war, essentially?
Exactly. They were now classed as ordinary criminals, which was a huge blow to the Republican movement.
A denial of their ideology, a way of undermining their struggle in their eyes.
Absolutely. The removal of special category status was seen as a direct attack on their identity as political prisoners. And their protest, their demand for its reinstatement, escalated into a hunger strike.
A hunger strike led by Bobby Sands. Sands, who would become a powerful symbol of the struggle. His image, gaunt and defiant, was splashed across newspapers worldwide. What made Sands' story so resonant? Was it the fact that he was elected to Parliament while on hunger strike?
His election was definitely a pivotal moment. Here he was, a man on the brink of death, deemed a criminal by the British government, yet the people of Fermanagh and South Tyrone elected him as their member of Parliament. It was a stunning indictment of the political situation, a clear message that a significant portion of the population supported his cause, his defiance.
And his death, along with the deaths of 9 other hunger strikers, sent shockwaves through Ireland and beyond. What was the impact of those deaths, those sacrifices?
It was devastating. It was a turning point of the conflict, further deepening divisions and hardening attitudes. It also led to a surge in support for Sinn Féin, which was seen as the political wing of the IRA. Many young people, radicalized by the hunger strikes and disillusioned with the lack of progress towards a united Ireland, joined the ranks of the IRA.
It's a reminder that even the most peaceful forms of protest, like a hunger strike, can have unintended and tragic consequences. So, with tensions at a boiling point, did any attempts at a political solution emerge from the ashes of the hunger strikes?
It did, though it ultimately ended in disappointment. Gerrit Fitzgerald, the Taoiseach of the Republic of Ireland, deeply concerned by the escalating violence and the potential for further bloodshed, proposed a new initiative, the New Ireland Forum.
Fitzgerald, a man who had consistently championed peace and dialogue, what was his vision for this forum?
Fitzgerald's idea was to create a space for open and honest dialogue, bringing together constitutional nationalist parties from both Northern Ireland and the Republic. Their goal, to explore potential solutions to the conflict, to find a way out of the impasse. The forum's deliberations culminated in a report published in 1984, which outlined 3 main options for the future of Northern Ireland: a unitary Irish state, a federal or confederal arrangement, or joint British-Irish authority.
So, a range of possibilities, from unification to some form of shared sovereignty. How was the report received? Did it offer a realistic path forward?
It was a significant document, a serious attempt to address the complex issues at the heart of the conflict. Crucially, it acknowledged the fears and aspirations of both communities, recognizing the Unionist desire to remain part of the United Kingdom while also addressing nationalist aspirations for a united Ireland.
It sounds like a step in the right direction, but we know the Troubles didn't end in 1984. So what went wrong? Why didn't the new Ireland Forum lead to a breakthrough?
The Forum faced a major obstacle from the outset. The Unionist parties, deeply suspicious of any attempt to weaken Northern Ireland's ties to the United Kingdom, boycotted it entirely. And Sinn Féin, although invited, also refused to participate. They saw the Forum as a talking shop, a distraction from their goal of a united Ireland.
So a lack of trust, a lack of buy-in from key players. And to make matters worse, just a few months after the Forum's report was published, the IRA bombed the Grand Hotel in Brighton.
A devastating attack, targeting the Conservative Party conference and narrowly missing Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Her response, delivered with her characteristic defiance, was a flat-out rejection of all three options outlined in the New Ireland Forum. Her message was clear: Northern Ireland was part of the United Kingdom. And that was non-negotiable.
So much for dialogue and compromise. Looking back at this decade, from the collapse of power sharing to the hunger strikes, the rise of the peace people, and the New Ireland Forum, it's hard to escape a sense of stalemate. Was there any progress at all towards peace?
It's easy to view this period as a decade of lost opportunities, a time when violence overshadowed any attempts at dialogue or reconciliation. But that wouldn't be telling the whole story. While a concrete political solution remained elusive, this decade was far from static. It was a period of intense upheaval, of both tragedy and hope. It was a time when new voices emerged, challenging the status quo and demanding to be heard. It was also a time when the economic realities of the conflict came into sharp focus, highlighting the need to address issues like poverty and discrimination.
So perhaps the seeds of change, the foundation for the eventual peace process, were being sown even amidst the violence and the political deadlock.
Precisely. The path to peace is rarely linear. It's often messy, marked by setbacks and disappointments. But this decade, as turbulent as it was, laid some of the groundwork for what was to come. It forced people to confront uncomfortable truths, to recognize the need for dialogue, and to acknowledge the shared humanity of all involved.
What a powerful reminder that even in the darkest of times, hope persists and the possibility of a better future remains. A huge thank you to our expert for joining us on this journey through such a complex and challenging period in history. And to you, our listeners, we hope this deep dive has given you new insights into the long road to peace in Northern Ireland. If you're eager to delve deeper, be sure to check out the chapter we explored today, Stalemate and the Search for Peace, 1974-1984. And until next time, remember to keep asking those tough questions, keep exploring those hidden corners of history, and keep the conversations going.